And I think there's no question that qualitatively we can. What I'll try to address is, if you try to make any kind of a quantitative comparison between these two things, what do you find happens? And this is a theory we can solve with strong coupling, and we can expand at weak coupling. This is something we can expand at weak coupling and hope to work out its behavior from experiments at strong coupling. So most people have stuck to looking at this at strong coupling, and I'm going to try to, we know the strong coupling, and I'm going to try to see how the weak coupling is coming on the other side to get an idea of how they cross, and then I can also compare this guy weak coupling to this guy weak coupling to see how alike or different the two theories really are. And we've already seen earlier today that viscosity, in particular scaled by the entropy density, is a nice, interesting measurable that I'm going to take as the object of my consideration for making this comparison. And this is work done with Sang-Yong Jin, who's not here, and Simon Karanyul, who's sitting right there in the white shirt. Okay, so first I'll go over things that I don't need to go over because Uli already said them. In the heavy ion collision, we take two flat pancakes, which you should each think of as being made out of a whole bunch of little quarks and gluons and stack them together, and we get an almond sliver-shaped piece of quarks and gluons resulting from a scattering one of these guys with one of these guys. Actually, most of these guys just continue straight through. What I'm drawing is the ones which scatter at large angles so that they're not just going to be in some kind of a fragmentation regions, but you'll see them in the middle of your detector. Okay. If the coupling were weak, that at each place in this almond, the guys you have were the result of one column of things coming this way and a column of things coming this way. Those columns don't care about, they don't make any distinctions about this azimuthal direction. And so while I will certainly not get a spherically symmetric or probably even a boost invariant distribution of charges, there's no reason I shouldn't get at least an azimuthally symmetric distribution of charges at each point in this, initially, in this this flat almond. And the thickness, you know, the number of particles.
On the contrary, at any point, it cannot possibly know about the shape of the almond.
Well, it can only know about the shape of the it can only know about the shape of the it can only know about the shape of the almond in the sense that there are gradients in the densities of the two things, which is some small correction that I'm not going to worry about. Okay, so in each place, I'm going to get something which is azimuthally isotropic. And it may be there are more or higher energy guys here, or fewer or possibly lower energy guys here, but at each point it's going to be isotropic. If they never interacted with each other, then each of these guys would fly out and maybe have an eyes on their way and hit our detector, and we would, no matter what shape this almond was, we would see something which was azimuthally symmetric in our hadron distribution. If, on the other hand, they interact strongly with each other, then I should think of them rather as behaving like a fluid. And fluids, then, I should describe in terms of things like pressure and pressure gradients. And now looking at the sliver, the skinny version of the almond. So here's my almond, I'm now turning it sideways. So it's very flat because the original pancakes were so Lorentz contracted. So in this region, there's a very strong density and therefore pressure gradient. Whereas in the tops and bottoms, that sort of the edges of the almond, it's a very gradual pressure and temperature gradient. And this pressure gradient is going to push this sort of surface layer here to throw it off in these directions, whereas these layers are going to be thrown much more gently. There's a way of thinking about that if you take, for a moment, let's pretend that the guys were freely flying again. Okay, we'll go back to the possibility they're being weakly coupled. These guys in the middle here were all, that I'm going to claim that the same effect will happen at first, but it won't persist. Okay? And the reason is because these guys in the middle started out right here, there were people flying in all directions, but the ones which were moving forward a moment later, after it goes from being filling this region to filling this region, the ones that will be here are the ones which were moving forward. And so you'll only find forward guys here. And the ones that were moving backwards will now be backwards, so you'll only find backwards moving guys here. And in the middle, you only find the guys who weren't moving forward and backwards because they all left to the edges. You'll just find things which have momenta in the plane. Okay? That's if they don't ever scatter with each other. And this effect that you find a forward moving region here and a backward moving region here, is at least initially the same as the physics of this pressure throwing this thing off. What's going to be different is that if they don't rescatter, then after some amount of time, you're going to get a momentum distribution locally, which is not spherical in the local rest frame. So here's a picture of the same thing. The same physics happens in the plane because of the almond being an almond rather than an almond sliver rather than a macadamia nut sliver or something. It's not a round flat thing, it's an almond flat thing. And so in this plane also, you have more things thrown out to the side than thrown top and bottom. If they didn't rescatter, you would get a momentum distribution like this locally. But you know that if you add those up over all places, then my original argument, you have equal px squared and py squared. It's just that the px is now all stored in local frame motion, and the py is stored in the random motion within each spot. But if they rescatter, then this py will get mixed and turn into this px. And that's going to lead to this measure v2, which Ulrich talked about this morning. So this is a measure of how much these guys rescatter and these distributions re-become spherical. Okay, no longer. And the data says that really happens. And it happens, as Ulrich explained, probably just about as vigorously as it could if the scattering were perfect and the thing were always acting like it was locally in equilibrium. So V2 seems to be as large as it could be, in the sense that ideal hydrodynamics seems to work, as Ulrich discussed this morning. And ideal hydro is just a statement that A, which is a truism, the stress tensor is conserved, and B, which is actually information content, because this is four equations. This is 10 unknowns. I need something to tell me six other pieces of information. And six other pieces of information are the claim that this thing can be determined from just the energy density and momentum contribution components by an equation of state. There's a pressure determined by the energy density, and it essentially determines what the space-space components of the stress tensor are from what the space-time and time-time components are. Now, this is true if you're in equilibrium at every point. If we want to keep track of the failure of scatterings to be perfect, then we have to put in the first corrections that could happen. And viscosity simply parameterizes the first correction that could happen as derivative of the flow of the fluid. If the viscosity is non-zero, now look at that fluid again. I said after a moment, if the two beams are coming from here and here so that I have a pancake, after a moment that pancake is expanding, here it's moving that way, here it's moving that way. In this situation, the beam axis derivative of the beam axis velocity is non-vanishing. And if you look at the expressions in the last thing, that will reduce the stress along this axis. And therefore, this stuff won't get pushed as hard as it would have. If there's viscosity, it won't get pushed as hard as if there isn't viscosity. Similarly, for this picture, this stuff won't get pushed off this side as hard in a viscous system as in a non-viscous system. And so that's going to reduce this. Okay, so we want to compute what this eta is. I know how to do that in weak coupling QCD. Now, weak coupling QCD is certainly not probably really valid, but at least it's something where I can make the calculation and I can try to extrapolate from there. I don't even have the technology for trying to do it in strong coupling. So let me at least figure out what it does in weak coupling, and then we can either try to extrapolate it or laugh at it. At weak coupling, I can really think of things in terms of relatively long-lived quasi-particles, and then I sort of know what to do. The stress tensor is given by an integral over, there shouldn't be a hand there, an integral over those particles of their individual contribution to stress, which is given by the I and J components of the momentum over their energy. I think the 2 shouldn't be there. 2 is a mistake. And the equilibrium, the number of those guys is going to depart from equilibrium because the derivative of the velocity means that the particles at some place were flying from a different place where the momentum distribution was different. and they're going to carry information about that. So I'm going to get a departure from equilibrium, which is proportional to the gradient of the velocity. Proportionality, just by sort of the fact that this is a scalar, has to go as the momentum ij. This is just what happens when you hit a population function with a derivative. And then scattering, this is what you would get as sort of how fast the departure from equilibrium developed. Okay, and then if you're going to have scatterings, then they're going to constantly be trying to remove that again. And so the inverse of the scattering efficiency is going to sit in here. And that's actually some operator. It's not just a number. Okay, so this is what you have to deal with. Basically, the ugly thing about dealing with shear viscosity is that you have to invert an operator of how collisions work in order to figure out what this departure from equilibrium is. Okay. And since this involves the inverse of the collision rate, it's going to involve inverse of coupling. And so my coupling, I'm going to end up with inverse powers of the coupling and viscosity. The most important collision process is Coulomb scattering. And this scares me because when I look at the cross section, I discover that it's quadratically divergent. This is known since at least Rutherford. But who cares if something scatters by some tiny little angle? That doesn't really change whether it's out of equilibrium or not. Out of equilibrium is everybody rushing backwards or forwards and nobody rushing up and down. You take one of the forward rushers and you make them rush forward plus some tiny angle, you're still out of equilibrium. You really have to get their direction changed 90 degrees to put yourself in equilibrium. So it turns out there's a Q squared suppression for how important small angle scatterings are. And then this is only log divergent. And the logarithm is cured by thermal medium effects, which just puts in sort of an infrared cutoff on how big this divergence looks. But it's still infrared dominated, the scattering process. And so they're sensitive to all the kinds of electric physics that we heard is so poorly constrained or poorly understood in the last talk. Okay. So we did the calculation in QCD, essentially solving for what this horrible collision operator is in weak coupling. And here's our result for this combination. Is this exactly 8 over S, but this is an old plot, and so we were calling it 8 over enthalpy times temperature instead, which is the same thing. As a function of the coupling string alpha strong, and we see, as we should expect, that at weak coupling, the viscosity is very large, and then it falls off, and then beyond about here, I don't really believe the plot anymore, because we're certainly out of the domain of applicability of weak coupling. But if I just mindlessly extrapolate, then I would say that a coupling which maybe possibly is relevant for Rick, I'm down somewhere around 8 over S and a half. The problem is that I don't really believe this end of the plot.
This is leading log?
This is leading order.
Leading order.
Yeah. And then it turns out there are some ambiguities in how you do leading order, and it's some particular resolution of the ambiguities, which you can read about.
Can all the technology that Tony talked about help you go to higher order? Or is it just too different?
No. I mean, this actually technically already involves some infinite resummations. And since they're all in real time and frequency, then they're nastier than they are for thermodynamic quantities. It might be somebody can do next to leading order, which is to find the order G corrections. But I believe that that's very hard. And I would never give it to a student as a project. Unless they ask me explicitly. Okay. Well, what else can we do? Well, why don't we just use the lattice, which would be the answer to Tony Redmond's whole talk. Well, just do the lattice, and there's the answer. Except that the lattice is great at doing thermodynamics. It's extremely hard to squeeze dynamics out of the lattice. I think Gerhard Arts will give us a talk. Are you going to discuss that kind of thing? Yeah. So would you agree with this statement? If you agree, then everyone here agrees.
I agree, it's difficult, but it's not
impossible. It's probably not impossible, but I don't think we managed to do it yet. Okay, chiral perturbation theory, well, that works at low temperatures, but that's not what we're interested in. Are there other techniques like instantons or quark models or something? I don't think that there's anything here where you can put the stamp of this is reliable calculation within genuine QCD on it. And maybe, well, why don't we find a theory that's sort of like QCD, but we can solve it, and then try to figure out how close the theory is to actually being QCD. And obviously, that's what I'm going to turn to next. So think about N equals 4 super Young Mills. This is a theory, well, I can't solve it, but I know people who can. And in this theory, Well, you don't know, who knows what, because originally I wrote these slides for a less n equals 4 super Yang Mills savvy audience, so I'll not insult you by telling you what the theory is. But Polycastro sonnet starnets, unless you want me to, it's just what happens when you take supersymmetry in 10 dimensions and you dimensionally reduce it to 4. In 10 dimensions, you have to have this awkward 16-component Majorana fermion. And in 4 dimensions, that just looks like 4 Majorana fermions. And in 10 dimensions, you have 10 components in your gauge field. And when you reduce them, 6 of them turn into sort of little A-naughts, which are scalar fields. And so you get 6 real scalar fields and 4 Majorana fermions. And the fact that you started out with a theory with only gauge interactions completely determines all the couplings. So that's what the theory is. And Polycastro, Son, and Starinets managed to calculate the shear viscosity to entropy ratio in this theory and got a remarkably simple answer, 1 over 4 pi. And then along with Pavel Kovtun, they analyzed a number of other theories with gravity dools and kept on getting the same answer. And so as one of them will explain, there's a proposal. Maybe this is the lowest you can get, although Thomas Cohen, I think, has recently argued that if you have theory with sufficiently exponentially large number of degrees of freedom, then you allow yourself to look at long-lived metastable states, you might be able to squeeze past this. But I won't worry about it. In this theory, you get 1 over 4 pi as well. And there's sort of a good reason that you shouldn't expect to get any lower than that, because roughly what you're saying is that you have one scattering that what you're looking at either over S is sort of like the time between scatterings times the particle energy. And the particle energy is really a frequency. It's a frequency where you have to wait for one of that time period for that frequency to even be able to say that there's a particle. That's the Einstein frequency for the particle. And surely something can't scatter more often than its own Einstein frequency, because it's not even a thing on time scales shorter than that. So it seems like that's the fastest you could possibly have scattering happen. And that sort of explains what this limit is going to be. Okay. Now these two theories look a lot the same. Well, first of all, they're both QCD. They just have a different matter content. And in some respects, they behave a lot the same. Super Yang Mills has this ratio of energy density to free energy density of 3/4, and as we've already seen, past about 1.5 or 2 TC, that's basically what QCD shows as well. And Super Yang Mills has a couple more fields, and they're adjoined instead of fundamental, but it seems like it's not that different, so maybe since we're interested in QCD where it's strongly coupled, it's reasonable to speculate that its answer won't be too different from what Super Yang Mills is, and it might be a reasonable sort of tracer. And so, well, that's stimulated a lot of interest in sort of making parallel calculations of what we've done in QCD in Super Yang Mills, where you can explore the strong coupling side. I'm going to try to test this comparison and to try to just explore more completely what's going on in Super Yang Mills theory by doing the weak coupling side as well. And then seeing, A, how does the weak coupling Super Yang Mills and the strong coupling Super Yang Mills connect together in the middle? And B, how different are these two theories at weak coupling? And does that give me any hint about what's going to happen with QCD at strong coupling? So that's sort of my goal here. Okay. Now let me go through a little more detail what one of these calculations really looks like. If I'm at weak coupling, then I have a quasi-particle picture, which is the statement that the density matrix is close to being a two-particle density. If you give me in the initial conditions what the, oh, I'm missing a closed bracket here, sorry, what the two-point function at equal time is, then that basically tells me what's going on in the plasma. It tells me where the particles are and what they're doing. And this two-point function should be given roughly by a distribution function times on-shell delta function. And at negative frequency, it's 1 plus distribution. For an equilibrium situation, this distribution function is just the ordinary distribution function we're used to. The propagator, of course, satisfies Fingered Dyson equation, the box of the propagator is given by the self-energy times the propagator. The self-energy is a is an ugly thing. It has one contribution, which is some kind of a just a shift to the mass of the particle, which isn't too interesting, and so I'll just absorb it into what I mean by P mu. It has another contribution, which is its complex, its imaginary part. And its imaginary part you can untangle to discover the, what it's describing as collisions. So there are essentially arrived collisions essentially represent the imaginary part of a self-energy for some particle. And the way to think about that is, here's a particle, here's a self-energy for it. The, well, if you connect these lines, then it's a self-energy for it. Cut that in half, and each half of it is a matrix element, so that the self-energy is just the square of a matrix element, where these are the other external particles in the scattering process. And you have to allow these scattering particles each to be either in the initial or final state of the working effect. So the sum over scattering processes. When you evaluate these diagrams, what you're just doing is you're integrating over each of the extra external momenta. A distribution function describing, well, what's the cut propagator? And then a matrix element squared, which is just the square of this, well, it's just this diagram times this diagram. And so that's really exactly what you expect a collision operator to look like. Okay, so what we have to do, we have to solve this equation using that collision operator. Okay, and the reason that it is a little tricky, first of all, because we have to invert that collision operator, and that involves solving some integral equation. But to make life a little more complicated, we have massless or light external states. And one of the first things you hopefully learn when you start doing field theory, where you really actually worry about what happens in experiments, is that whenever you have massless or light external states, there's an order g squared chance that either in the initial state or in the final state, they'll split into a pair. So this is the origin of initial state radiation, and it's the reason for the evolution of Parton distribution functions. Just trying to understand these splittings completely gives you the Dirac equations. Now, Coulomb scattering happens all the time. Its cross section involves a g squared instead of the g to the fourth that you might have expected. But every one of these scatterings, even though it's by a small angle, can still lead to a splitting of the incoming or outgoing particles, which changes the total particle number. And that turns out to be a major correction to whether you're close to equilibrium. And so you have to include these splitting processes from these wimpy little Coulomb scatterings in order to get a complete leading order calculation. And then the real problem is that this splitting is very sensitive to whether this is a light state or whether it's a massless state. And the plasma switches it from being massless to being light. And in addition, the reason these splittings happen so well is because there's a long time before and after the collision for the fragments to undergo the splitting. And well, in a thermal medium, there isn't a long time because then they hit the next collision. And multiple collision processes can be coherent between them. But the splitting involving different collisions can have coherence across them. So you have to be careful. And usually, at this point, I show some scary set of equations, but I decided not to today. In order to treat these splitting processes, it's in fact, it's not sufficient to think about just 2-to-2 scattering or 2-to-3 scattering, but then you have to sum 4-to-5 scattering, 6-to-7 scattering, etc. So in fact, you have to sum some infinite set of diagrams, although it's a particularly simple infinite set of diagrams. But you have to sum that in order to get this collision operator, which you then have to invert in order to find out what the departure from equilibrium is. And if you try to express everything in terms of diagrams, it means you have an infinite resum set of diagrams sitting as some kernel inside of the infinite resummation of some other set of diagrams. So at leading order, this is already relatively nasty. Anyway, it can be done. And what you find for Supriang-Mills theory, I've done a log-log plot here. As I explained, the shear viscosity goes as inverse powers of the coupling. It goes as the inverse second power of the Tolf coupling. And so you get a line of slope approximately minus 2 here. It's not quite exactly minus 2 because there are some log corrections, but it's close. And where this line goes from being solid to being dotted is where I really don't believe the answer to better than a factor of 2, because, for instance, I can do the same calculation in this funny large NF theory, and there I don't have to perform any expansions. I can just do the calculation. And I can switch over and do exactly the same approximations and expansions that I did here and say, did it work? And right about where I stopped doing this is at the same Debye screening scale where it stopped working in the large NF theory. And so this is really definitely an extrapolation that could easily have factor of 2 error. Here's the strong coupling result. And here's the next to leading order result. And you can see by here, also, I don't really know what's happening at strong coupling to better than. But it looks like there's no way that this thing is down to the strong coupling result at top coupling of 2 or 3. It seems more reasonable that it switched from these curves, that it switches over from being weak coupled to strong coupled somewhere around 10 or 15 in the top coupling. So my best guess is that in super Yang mills, you're within about a factor of 2 of the strong coupling behavior at lambda TUF coupling of around 15. And this is based on the usual argument that whenever you see something on a log-log plot where you've got a slope like that and a slope like that, and you say, what happens? It turns over with a sort of 3 dB above the intersection point. Okay. Now, and if I just directly say, at what value of alpha strong is the tough coupling 15 in QCD, the answer is about 0.4. Now, the question is that a realistic estimate of where QCD should encounter a similar turnover from weak to strong coupling? And I'm going to argue that it isn't, because QCD and super Yang mills in a respect aren't that similar. First of all, in this calculation, as I said, it's actually, even though we had to do this complicated resummation of splitting processes, they turned out not to have that big a contribution. Really, mostly what determines the shear viscosity is Coulombic scattering. And Coulombic scattering, there are two things that decide how fast Coulombic scattering is. First, how many targets are there? And second, how strongly do you couple the gauge bosons? Coupling the gauge bosons goes as a Casimir, which is larger for an adjoint than for a fundamental representation particle by about a factor of 2. The number of scattering targets involves some sum over all the degrees of freedom you have of some kind of group invariant, which for super Yang mills, because of all of these scalars and fermions and because of their being adjoint, turns out to be about 4 times as large as the comparable number in QCD. So when you say, well, there are a few more degrees of freedom in super Yang mills, if you count them using the appropriate statistics and representation dependent prefactors, it's really 4 times as many degrees of freedom. Now, let me remind you, why did we use this tough coupling, lambda equals g squared nc, rather than g squared, which is the actual coupling, to describe how strongly coupled the theory is? Well, it's because this nc here represents sort of a number of degrees of freedom. And even if the coupling between any 2 degrees of freedom is very small, when you add it up over all the different degrees of freedom which can be interacting, it's really a strongly coupled theory when this combination becomes large. Well, here I see there are 4 times as many things here in the super Yang mills than in the QCD. So it seems like I should really define a lambda tilde, which is then multiplying by this extra number of degrees of freedom, which suggests that a coupling of g squared nc of 4 in the super Yang mills is then 4 times as strong coupling as g squared nc of 4 in QCD. And so really, you know, 4 in super Yang mills correspond to 16 in ordinary QCD. I'm going to try to test whether that kind of a
analysis makes sense.
Yeah, this is the definition of lambda, but the question is, when you're comparing two theories, what is the most reasonable way of comparing those two theories? Should you compare g squared nc, or should you compare something which more accurately describes how strong the coupling is in terms of the strength of coupling and the number of degrees of freedom you're coupling to? And I argue that this more accurately describes the total. That's why I put a tilde over it.
No, but there is also an animal, or in QCD, lamp is a lamp, so depends where you compare it.
Yeah, it does.
So in this way, you should
yes, Steve. This
form?
When you write NDOF here, why wasn't it splitter than NDOF? Because the number of degrees of freedom in the game.
Well, okay, so the reason that this is NC instead of NC squared is because as you add more and more colors, fewer and fewer of them directly talk to each other. So if you take one guy and you see
this
how many.
Not number of degrees of freedom. This is.
No, it's not.
Enters into.
Well, okay, so for instance, it's exactly this combination which enters into the divine box.
So
NC squared doesn't really describe how many degrees of freedom you personally are interacting with.
He is
it's
not
NC which does.
Degrees of freedom. This is, that's why
yeah, it's really a strength of coupling, total strength of coupling average, something over everybody. And then, in loop factors. And this is a more appropriate, this is a more appropriate estimate for that. Okay. And furthermore, in super young mills, I have these extra Yukawa and scalar interactions not present in QCD, and I can imagine that they pump up the answer a little bit too. And I have more collinear processes because Yukawa interactions can also lead to collinear processes. So for instance, if I think that comparing things at the same value of NCG squared is the appropriate thing to do, then why don't I just compare value of eta over s between QCD and super young mills at the same value of lambda? And what I find out is that the super young mills is way lower than three flavor QCD by a factor of something like 7.
But this
shows you that it's not appropriate to compare QCD and super young mills at the fixed value of lambda.
At which normalization point it's compared?
Okay, so this is calculated at leading order. The question of what normalization point I'm using is a next to leading order question. So weak coupling, I don't have to answer that question. At strong coupling, I don't trust the result. At weak coupling, I don't have to answer.
How do you calculate the next one?
If you want to calculate it, I recommend that you do. But nobody's done it yet.
Yeah.
Nobody has calculated to a level which tells you how to fix the normalization point. You would need to know the g squared corrections. The first corrections to this curve enter in order g, and they're not known.
No, but so it is a result for say viscosity, right? Or what quantity is calculated?
Viscosity.
I see. So
viscosity natural, over entropy.
I see. So the natural scale was there. It was temperature, right? Or what?
Yeah.
It's much more complicated than that.
Yeah. So anyway,
in the leading order.
Yeah.
What do you mean much more complicated? You're doing integration. You know how which range you are effectively calculating because it's a finite answer, right? So when you are saying that it's more complicated, you
okay. If you want, the renormalization point dependence of this curve is quite narrow at such a small value of lambda in QCD. So it's not very important.
So don't the temperature. It's just
Right.
Yeah. So it's so right. Also order of temperature still, right? Or you are saying that it's not.
But if I compare, theories at the same value of m Dubai.
You just calculated one loop. It's not a thermal. I thought we were discussing
viscosity. Right,
but he's MD is in there, and it's calculated in one loop. That's right. So you don't yet know what normalization point you should be choosing, and you don't yet see the sensitivity to that. Okay. So if I take into account this issue of counting degrees of freedom as they enter in the device speeding mass, and I take into account the different chasm, then instead of this very discrepant comparison, I get this actually quite tight comparison. Here's super young mills, and here are a bunch of different versions of QCD. Zero flavor, three flavor, infinite flavor. So it seems that, you know, really including this is an appropriate way of matching the scaling or of scaling between these guys and comparing them at what effectively is the same coupling strength.
Okay. Essentially, what you say that zero flavors and infinite number of flavors are much closer to each other.
Yeah, and why? Because all of these theories only interact via gauge interactions. This theory, in addition, has scalar and Yukawa interactions. So there are more ways of scattering. So you shouldn't be surprised that the answer is pulled down because there are extra ways of getting towards equilibrium. Yeah, but this is still, you know, a 30% discrepancy. It's not a factor of 7. So these theories are not that different from each other. At weak coupling, if you scale things in terms of M Dubai and in terms of these average Casimirs and things, then they're not that different. Whether they're still not that different in strong coupling is a completely different question. But I can, you know, try to extrapolate, and I will, because, you know, I don't necessarily trust my extrapolation to great accuracy, but I should try. Now I'm going to say, supposing I take QCD at alpha strong of 0.5, which is maybe about the right value for being a factor of 2 above the phase difference. And, you know, I'll take this with a grain of salt, but I'm going to use it to try to get an estimate of what's relevant for QCD. That scaling with this number of degrees of freedom, with sort of the leading order Debye, the way the degrees of freedom contribute to the leading order Debye screening, now suggests that that corresponds to a lambda of about 4.5 on the super Young Mills side of things. And if I go to 4.5 on this plot, I see I'm still well on the side where I'm in the weak coupling part of this curve, not the strong coupling. And so I would estimate I'm still a factor of a few above the viscosity bound. Few meaning factor of 4 or so. And that analogy is not really quite fair, because when I do this rescaling, because of the way that Debye's and Casimir's enter here, I actually also learned that I was supposed to scale this thing, the answer that I got down by about 30%, the fact that these curves differed by about 30% out here. That's sort of a wash. So I estimate that you should be something like 3 or 4 times the viscosity bound at QCD when you're getting to a coupling, up to about where it's really becoming non-conformal. And if it's really strongly non-conformal, closer to TC, then I don't really believe that super Young Mills could be a very good analog theory anyway, because it's a conformal theory. So my conclusion is there's a region where QCD and N equals 4 super Young Mills actually behave quite similarly in weak coupling. But one should not compare lambda to lambda. One should compare lambda times some count of degrees of freedom to lambda times some count of degrees of freedom. And that means that what corresponds to alpha strong getting close to the phase transition is really lambda of around 4, which is still more on the weak than on the strong coupling side.
But not on the degrees of freedom, I have quotation marks. This is in your definition. It's not the number of degrees of freedom, they count.
Yeah, right. Right. In particular, it counts adjoint things is about twice as much as fundamental things, and it counts bosons twice as much as fermions. But that's appropriate for asking in plasma how much are they doing in terms of scattering. So that's the reason I'm counting that way. It's not G star.
No, but if, say, Lily is right about, say, different scale involved, then even, you know, notion of one is in the same lambda could be in doubt, right? Because if it's the same scale, at least, say, Cambridge, right? Then at least you're...
Well, again, I'm interested in QCD where its scale dependence is not that strong, because if its scale dependence is strong, I know super Young Mills isn't a good analog.
Sure.
And super Young Mills doesn't have any scale dependency normalization, so I'm not worried about that. So anyway, a funny thing, though, is we said earlier, much earlier in the talk, look, I passed it, not that much earlier, apparently. Where is it? That the ratio of the pressure to the Stefan Boltzmann one is actually not that far from Steve's result from the 90s, 3/4, at 2 or 3 times TC. But what we saw in the last talk was that at lambda of 2 or 4, you're already approaching that strong coupled thermodynamic behavior. But interestingly, it seems like you need to be at, you know, 3 or 4 in lambda to get the thermodynamic behavior to look like the strong coupling one. But you need to be above 10 to get the dynamic behavior to seem like the strong coupling one, which is a discrepancy that I don't completely understand, but I think is interesting. So,
why is that puzzling?
Well, I don't know if it's puzzling. It's interesting. Okay, so, but usually you would think you're either in weak coupling or you're in strong coupling. And now I find out that if you're interested in thermodynamics, you may already be well into strong coupling, and your dynamics are still very different from your
coupling. Transport is always more sensitive than...
Yeah, I guess transport takes longer to... Yeah, okay, so anyway...
Actually, for lambda equal 2, there was more argument for the weak coupling regime.
But 4...
Four.
Yeah. It's closer to 3/4 than it is to 1/4. That was clear from your plot.
Yeah.
Okay. So Super Yang Mills actually implies that QCD would only approach this ratio at unachievable coupling, where it would be strongly nonconforming. Okay, so the Krishna, before I conclude.
No, that's all you're going to conclude, sorry.
Yeah. Okay, so in conclusions, N equals 4 is a very nice theory. And it's interesting to test whether it's a good analog theory for QCD. One can look at the test of weak coupling. What you find is that there are quantitative differences between the two because of the counter degrees of freedom in Casimir's. And you can rescale to try to get around these. But what that turns out to be is that what one means by strong coupling in Super Yang Mills is beyond where you already hit the mass gap in QCD. And so I suggest that QCD should be within a factor of a few, but not very close to the viscosity value.
We've had a lot of discussion, so maybe just a few urgent questions.
So if you were right that at QCD at, say, 2TC, Rick conditions, Ader over S is 3 or 4 times the bound, then I'll make 2 comments. First of all, then Uli should find even more enormous effects than he was finding this morning. But second of all, I just want to advertise again Harvey Meyer's lattice calculation of last month of Ader over S at 1.65 TC. And the thing that he has done, which it makes it a big step forward, is that his calculation of the Euclidean correlator has 50 times smaller error bars than before. And that makes it possible to get...
And how is he fitting it? Because exactly what you do to analytically continue that thing gives you enormous sensitivity to what answer you're giving.
You should read his paper. Look, I mean, he's doing it in a new way, which allows him to estimate errors in a way that seems reasonable. The answer is Ader over S at 1.65 TC is 0.134 plus or minus 0.033.
Oh, come on, Christian. So, this is the same paper where his strong statement is it not, that his lattice data strongly implies that Ader over S is less than 1.
Yes, I know, but
that's the believable statement.
No.
The second statement was with much, much larger caveats.
Sure, but I'm just, Larry, read the strong statement carefully, and you'll see that the strong statement makes a ridiculous assumption about the spectral function to get a conservative bound. It assumes that between it's rho of omega, between omega equals t and omega equals about 2 GeV, the spectral function is 0. And if you assume that, it's a way of putting as much weight as possible down near omega equals 0 to get as large an Ader over S as possible. Then you get Ader over S equals 1. That's how he puts the bound. I think we all agree that that's a very conservative bound, and the spectral function is not 0 for 1 decade of omega.
Well, I think I'll ask Claire what he thinks.
So,
I would like to ask a question about this talk rather than advertising Harvey's.
All I wanted to say is...
But first I want you to say something about Harvey's.
The real point about Harvey's is that at the beginning, it was done with 8 PCs, and he's now redoing it with a blue gene. So he will be able to go to larger volumes, finer time spacing, everything will get better, and we'll see if it survives.
I have a question about this plot. So in the plot where you extrapolate from weak coupling to strong coupling in this viscosity, the weak coupling result is known at leading order, and the strong coupling result is at leading and next to leading order.
Right.
So if you listen to Tony's talk, in the pressure, if you go to high order, it doesn't converge, it's a big mess. So what do you expect if you would be able to compute
I should do a pad 8 bit. Connect these guys together, and it'll be a beautiful, smooth curve that goes right like that. I don't know. What I really expect is that if I were able to do next leading order, that I would discover that this was losing theoretical control here. just as this is losing theoretical control here. It's kind of hard to try to figure out accurately what's going on in between. So the best I can do is I have a line here and a line here. And I say the usual rule is you should expect 3 dB at the intersection. And if you think it's somehow going to stick right along here and then flare up into that, then, well, I suppose that's possible and I can't exclude it. I would be surprised.
Okay, further discussion in the coffee break. We'll come back at 4:15. Please let's thank the guests.